I'm Bill Barole. Over the last few decades, I've done every kind of writing there is to do, from journalism to humor, books, movies, and television.
I'm Matt Ricardo. For the last 30 years, I've toured the world as a variety performer.
We've come together across the Atlantic to talk about creativity, what it is, where it comes from, why it matters.
Thomas Edison said, "To invent, you need a good imagination and a pile of junk."
This is Imagination and Junk, a conversation about the hard work of creativity.
Episode 29, Desire Lines.
Dear Matt, as we discussed in our last episode, the one about gathering the nerve to call yourself an artist, God, was it just 2 weeks ago? Were we ever really that young and innocent? As we discussed, I'm a fan of the late cartoon director, Chuck Jones. I met Jones once when I was an entertainment writer for Newsweek. Bruce Goldstein, the repertory programmer at Film Forum in Manhattan, knew I was a fan and arranged for me to have lunch with Jones when he came through town to help promote a home video release of his great Looney Tunes cartoons from the 1940s to the 1960s. I don't remember much of what we talked about, except that Jones bristled unattractively when I complimented Michael Maltese, the writer on many of Jones's cartoons featuring Bugs Bunny, Daffy Duck, and the rest. I realized immediately that I'd blundered into some ancient grudge, the details of which Jones may not even remember himself anymore, so I backpedaled and changed the subject as quickly as I could. I do remember being struck in the moment by how ungracious Jones was toward an old collaborator who hadn't gotten a tenth of the acclaim he himself had. You know what they say, never meet your heroes. Oh well. My admiration for Jones was undimmed by the encounter because the work is timeless. There's so much I admire about it. He was a master, Jones was, of physical comedy, who got to design and execute his gags with a precision that even Buster Keaton couldn't touch, because Jones's gags weren't subject to the worldly constraints of space and time. He literally painted them onto cellulose acetate at 24 frames per second. Jones had a deep understanding of comedy. He once said something to the effect that the difference between a laugh and no laugh could be one frame, could be a cut on frame 13 instead of frame 14. That's how precise he was. And in the series that was his masterpiece, the Coyote and Roadrunner cartoons beginning with Fast and Furious in 1949, he took that precision to new heights. People like to say that the great Warner Brothers cartoons were anarchic, and in some cases that's true. But the Coyote and Roadrunner cartoons, they were anything but. They're not anarchic so much, not nihilistic, or anything other than rigorous. How did that happen? Well, it wasn't an accident. In his 1999 memoir, Chuck Amok, Jones revealed 9 rules for cartoons in that series. It's not known exactly when he developed the rules. He died in 2002, but in all likelihood, he did so decades before the book in the 1950s and followed them strictly through the last edition he directed, War and Pieces, in 1963. The year Jack L. Warner shuttered the studio's animation unit. So what were these rules? They started with, the Roadrunner cannot harm the coyote except by going, meep meep. And they ended with, the coyote is always more humiliated than harmed by his failures. These bookends give the rules an existential gravity that's very much in sync with the cartoons. And my favorite rule is number 7. All materials, tools, weapons, or mechanical conveniences must be obtained from the Acme Corporation. Oh, Acme, your product line was so fantastically explodey. It'd be hard to find anybody who has an informed understanding of animation who wouldn't agree that the classic Coyote Roadrunner cartoons were among the greatest ever made. And it was, I'd argue, more than anything else, their strict, unyielding adherence to Jones' 9 rules that made them so. It gave them a gravity few cartoons could match. They're about big things, hope, mortality, futility, perseverance. Plus, they were funny. That's a good day's work. So, let's talk this week about the role of rules in creativity. Not limits, because we've already done an episode on that last season. God, were we ever that young and innocent. But rules, the principles you use to build out the superstructure of your work. that determine what you put in and what you leave out, that push you one way or another when you reach for a tool. In journalism, and bear with me while I once again date myself, the classic rules once revolved around fidelity to fact, if not always truth. I think we all know how that's been going lately. How about in your racket? What are the rules you follow when you step onto a stage? How do they lift you up, keep you honest, guide your hand? I'll talk to you next time, and Bill.
Beep, beep.
Dear Bill, you sent me on a brilliant Wikipedia rabbit hole, and I am now going to furnish you with my findings. The Acme Company, which some say is an acronym for America Company That Makes Everything, doesn't just exist in the fictional world of the Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote. No. It also exists in I Love Lucy and The Andy Griffiths Show, and earlier in the films of Harold Lloyd and the aforementioned Buster Keaton. Which means, surely, that all of these people inhabit the same universe, since they all do business with the same Unreal Corporation. Consider me holding out hope for a Lost Roadrunner Buster Keaton Lucille Ball crossover movie. Also, according to Forbes magazine, the official magazine of airport first class lounges, Acme is the second largest fictional company in the world, with an estimated annual revenue of $348.7 million. Five places ahead of the failing Soylent Inc., with a paltry $157.1 million annual revenue. I blame the vegans. You are, of course, right in everything you say about Chuck Jones and his work. Those cartoons are the last great silent movies, the last example of pure slapstick. You're also right when you say that rules are not the same as limits. The beauty of using the medium of animation to create physical comedy is that you don't have to obey the rules of the physical part, and you can focus completely on the comedy part. You aren't dependent on budgets restricting scale. You can let your imagination be as big and wide-ranging as possible to just serve the gags, and the most you'll be costing your studio is a little more ink. The closest anyone got to this in the non-animated world might be Jacques Tati's film Playtime. It is absolutely a masterpiece, and correctly on every list of the greatest films ever made. It is, in every sense, what you get when you give a great clown carte blanche to make whatever is in their head. It's startlingly beautiful, very funny, incredibly clever, heartfelt. But I say in every sense because it also took more than 3 years to film, involved the construction of an entire section of fully functioning city, forced him into bankruptcy, and on its release, flopped. Chuck Jones didn't need to spend years building a city for his jokes to live in, he could just draw one. And so, when you have no limits on the playground for your comedy, you do need rules. And Roadrunner cartoons are all about rules. There's a bird going somewhere by road. There's a coyote always hungry. Clowning is always about struggle, desire, what the clown wants, the ways they'll try to get it, and how they fail. Roadrunner seems to be the perfect symbol of constant. A rule, maybe. Speeding from right to left, heralded by his beep beep, regular as clockwork. To be interrupted by the clown, the haphazard anarchy of a clumsy animal whose hunger is making him stupid. It's the circus clown interrupting the ringmaster, Jerry Lewis interrupting Dean trying to sing a song. The rules are the straight man, and the anarchy is the comic. So you ask what rules I use when I work, and I think this is one of those things where the closer you look, the more you'll find, probably a few that I don't even realise I'm doing until I really think about it. But here's my starting point. I establish what I'm here for, that these people have paid to come and be entertained, and I'm the person who will do that. Often,
I'll even say something exactly to that effect. Once me and the audience agree on those basics, then I can start to play with them. Because at that point, I've become me playing the part of a very slightly fictionalized version of me. Just like pro wrestling, this stuff is the most interesting when it's real and not real at the same time. I am pretending to be a version of what I really am. I've established the rule, the power structure. Then I can make it textured and more interesting and hopefully funny too, by layering and subverting that by introducing that clown struggle or world-weary cynicism. I can be hurt when they don't clap as much as I think they should. I can be smug when I land a particularly good trick, and then have that smugness shattered when I trip over putting my props away. I establish the rules of who I am and why I'm here, and then I show the human trying to abide by those rules. What I am is the straight man. Who I am is the clown. What I am is Roadrunner. Who I am is Coyote. At least on stage. In real life, I've always felt much more like a slappy squibble. The rules
Dear
say
Matt,
that I'll talk to you soon.
It's interesting that you zeroed in on the idea of anarchy in the Coyote Roadrunner cartoons, especially after I specifically said that the cartoons aren't anarchic at all, and in fact are just the opposite, rigorous. Look, if you're going to openly disagree with me, then there's just no point. I mean, what are we even doing here? But sure, okay, fine. In the universe of comedy, which is more or less your racket, specifically in the kind of comedy that can be described as clowning, yes, the clown represents a challenge to authority. Rules are authority. When a clown comes banging into an orderly scene and demolishes it, you could say that's anarchic. But wait a second, isn't this opposition of forces itself a structure? A rule, even? Aha! I win! In journalism, where I've spent much of my career, the calculus is, I think, a little simpler. There are widely varying practices, but there's really just one rule. We serve fact. Now, you notice I didn't say truth, or even the truth, as if truth were ever just a singular thing. No, truth is for philosophers. Journalism is about fact. That's the way it's always been. This idea is built deep into the myth-making of the trade, and man, there's nobody who loves the myth of their own trade like journalists. If your mother says she loves you, one old adage goes, check it out. Here's another one, attributed to a number of people, most widely a teacher of journalism named Jonathan Foster. If one person says it's raining and another says it's dry, it's not your job to quote them both. It's your job to look out the fucking window and find out which is true. I'm afraid journalism has done an awful lot of quoting them both in recent years. So much so that there's a term of art for it, both-sidesism, in its verb form to both sides an issue. Both-sidesing reflects a failed negotiation between fact and truth. And this failure is, I think, one of the things that's driven the mistrust of legacy media over the last decade or so. People want the trade to traffic in truth because truth is under assault. But that's a philosophical shift the most prominent practitioners of the trade have been fatally slow to embrace. When the New York Times, which I want to say is still the best paper we have, when the New York Times sticks on the prissy legalistic distinction between misstatements and lies, hanging its hat on the idea that Donald Trump may not have known that the utter horseshit he was shoveling was in fact not true, so it may not technically be a lie, that kind of hair splitting is an anachronistic luxury, and it badly misreads the moment we're in. I have to say, the reluctance of my trade, particularly its legacy outlets, to interrogate the whole issue of fact versus truth in these particular times has been a dismal failure at a time when journalism has never been more critical. But self-criticism isn't, at least recently, a thing legacy journalism has done well. The New York Times fired its last public editor, a kind of internal watchdog, in 2017, and never replaced her. In fact, a couple of screenwriters, mind you, may have done the pithiest, most acute wrestling with this idea of a reality bigger and weightier than fact. In The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, directed in 1962 by John Ford, the writers James Warner Bella and Willis Goldbeck had a newspaper editor say,
"This is the West, sir. When the legend becomes fact,
and I'll talk to you next time. Print the legend. Bill.
Dear Bill, okay, let's clarify. Roadrunner cartoons themselves are indeed rigid. They follow an almost musical structure in terms of format. Verse, chorus, bridge, chorus. Plan, failed plan. Plan, failed plan. Plan, order something from Acme, and failed plan. I agree with you about that. But, Wile E. Coyote, anarchy. An unravelling mind fueled by hunger, desperation, and a need to finally succeed at the thing that consumes him. Within the unyielding rules of the Warner Brothers cartoon universe? Cartooniverse? Anyway, within that world, within its rules, there needs to be characters for whom these rules cause pain. The fun is in seeing how each character deals with their situation. Bugs Bunny, for example, effortlessly bends reality to his whim by simply being witty and cool.
Bugsy neighbor, could you spare a cup of black strap molasses? One cup of black strap molasses coming up. Funny, I didn't think molasses would run in January.
The coyote gets angry and blows himself up.
Meep, meep.
So yes, okay, fine, you're right. The anarchic clown versus a world of rules is itself a set of rules. Breaking a rule is as much a part of the system as abiding by it. Welcome to Imagination and Junk, the podcast about the hard work of existentially analysing Roadrunner cartoons. Your truth versus fact thing reminds me of one of my favourite, well, it's not quite a joke, but maybe it counts as one in this scientific community where it originates. Anyway, it goes like this. An engineer, a physicist, and a mathematician are on a train going north from London that had just crossed the border into Scotland. The engineer looks out the window and sees a black sheep grazing on the hillside. "Look," he says to his friends, "Scottish sheep are black." To which the physicist replies, No. Some Scottish sheep are black." The mathematician sighs heavily and says, "No. Here is what we know. In Scotland, there is at least one field containing at least one sheep, of which at least one side is black." I really like your hard differentiation of truth versus fact. I also love it whenever you talk about your life in journalism. It's romantic and noble. And I know that you'll want to say something snarky in response to that, but I'm also pretty sure that you agree. Which is why I bet it hurts to see the both sides-ism you talk about becoming the norm of how news is done. We're talking about rules, and it would seem that the new rules are in play here. Do not do anything that could be construed by one's corporate overlords to be an opinion, even if that opinion is based on fact. When the instruction is to both sides everything, but one of the sides is fact, then the only result is that the other side must be a lie. So, to present these two sides as equal, look, I'm only a juggler, but that seems like not quite the journalistic ideal. Welcome to Imagination and Junk, the podcast about the hard work of keeping sane in a Kafkaesque hellscape. That quote about printing the legend got me thinking. It sounds so great in the context of the Old West, the idea of writing the myths that form the soul of a nation and knowing that you're doing that. By printing legends about heroism, adventuring, the pioneer spirit, they were writing a set of rules about America. They knew that if you give people a good story, they'll do what you tell them. And that's advertising rather than journalism. I've strayed from the theme. Rules. Rules in creative work. Those writers printing the legend in the Old West in their proto-tabloids were probably pretty good writers. I bet they could bang out the kind of rip-roaring prose that made sure those legends had big print runs. I wonder how many of them had problems finding the balance between all the rules they were having to obey. Print the legend and make it exciting. That's what sells papers. So there's the main rule, but maybe that goes against the reason they picked up a pen in the first place, to look out the window and tell people if it's raining. That's also the main rule, or it used to be, or it should be. Oh, look at me being all idealistic. It's embarrassing. Okay, so here's where I'm landing. Even for the most avant-garde, art for art's sake type of creative, which, by the way, is absolutely something to shoot for, there are rules. From which way up to hold a brush to who's paying for the paint. Always have been. It's down to the creative person to navigate the useful rules, the fun rules, and the annoying rules to do the best art possible. That, in itself, is a creative act. Sometimes, often even if it's your art that pays the bills, you'll have to compromise and play by someone else's rules. That's just life. Well, it's mostly capitalism, which isn't the same thing as life, but you get my point. But you don't need to be a roadrunner, mindlessly ploughing on, only on the tarmac, only in one direction, to a never-reached destination. And you don't need to be a Wile E. Coyote, endlessly angered by the structures of your life, getting ever more self-destructive while achieving nothing. Be bugs. Be curious, silly, smart, mischievous. Eat your favourite food, turn left to Albuquerque, and occasionally dress in drag.
I would just love a duck dinner.
It confuses the people who make the rules.
Dear Matt, thanks
Talk
for the
to
joke.
You soon.
I enjoyed it, although it did strengthen my resolve to never go on a pleasure trip with scientists. I mean, can you imagine sitting there listening to these three overeducated dullards slicing reality into thinner and thinner pieces while your joy at being on a train journey slowly melts away into a dull ache of despair? Also, how have we gotten this far into an episode about rules without quoting Bob Dylan, who said in 1966's Absolutely Sweet Marie,
to live outside the law,
this is one
you
of Dylan's most famous lyrics that makes less and less sense the longer you think about them. Although some of his lyrics, to be fair, start out making no sense and stay that way. My favorite example of this is from his song, I Want You.
Now your dancing child with his Chinese suit. He spoke to me. I took his flute.
Dylan is a genius, but like many geniuses, hello Henry Kissinger, he has a lot to answer for. Anyway. You call it embarrassing to be idealistic about the role of journalism in the world. Unsurprisingly, I don't think it is, especially in today's world. It may be a dead trade or a dying one, and slippage of standards is only one of the many sharks circling it in the water right now. I'm looking at AI and thinking we're going to need a bigger boat. But as imperiled as it is, it can be one of the few remaining counterweights to a world gone all mean and crazy. It's interesting, though, how thoroughly the frontline role in that struggle has been ceded by old media, or legacy media, or the MSM, pick your poison, has been ceded to a new generation of, what? Rule breakers, benders of, in some cases ignorers of, the status quo ante. The Sunday shows, nightly news, the weekly news magazines I came up in, even to a large degree the great national newspapers, of which there are remaining in this country either one or two, depending on who you ask, have been supplanted by newer, nimbler, and, it has to be said, less mush-mouthed practitioners. For all that journalism has always liked to style itself as a trade, not a craft, or God knows as an art, as something practiced by tough, unsentimental characters, there's the romance of it again, print the legend. Underneath that has always been a shy decorousness about naming what's in front of it. The rules held that this simply wasn't done. Remember the example I cited in a previous segment? The New York Times stubbornly refusing to call what comes out of Trump's mouth lies, as opposed to falsehoods or untruths or some other gentlemanly evasion because, well, we can't know for sure whether Trump knows what he's saying isn't true, therefore we can't say for sure that it's technically, taxonomically, a lie. This is the best, by which I mean the worst, example of how old media is hamstrung by its gentility. That practice of gentility has always been, essentially, a rule. To the degree that it's now being rejected by what's still called alternative media, good for alternative media. There comes a time in every trade, every craft, every art, every act of creation, when the old ways need to be set aside. That doesn't always happen in extremis, as is the case with journalism. The Impressionists, to take just one example, overthrew the rules of the Academy, almost literally throwing open the windows and letting some air into the studio, because those rules were stifling them. Then, it was the Post-Impressionists' turn. Rejection, retrenchment, rebirth. New directions. The young overthrows the old. Always. That's a rule, too. I imagine it happens in your racket as well. In fact, I'm sure of it because I've seen All About Eve. I'll talk to you next time. Bill.
Dear Bill, I'm glad you like the joke about the people going on a train up to Scotland because I recently went on a train up to Scotland. As you know, I'm currently performing my show at the Edinburgh Fringe. So on that train journey, there weren't many scientists, just plenty of young theatricals with a dream in their heart, a spring in their step, and an overdraft in their future. I've been thinking about what you said about the New York Times, which these days, sadly, seems more and more like a former celebrity wearing a shirt of the team they played for decades ago in order to sell you a juicer on an infomercial. Anyway, I was thinking about their reticence to call Trump's lies, lies, because you can't be absolutely sure that he knew things weren't true when he said them, so they could have been mistakes. Which, by the way, ignores the obvious truth that he is years and years past caring if the things he says are true or not. The only metric by which the words tumble out of his mouth are how much he thinks they will enrich him in some way. Truth is a section of his brain long since eroded by Diet Coke. I guess the rationale behind the Times' achingly careful word choice is fair, or at least legally protective. But the choice it's making exists only in the current tense. It feels like it takes each episode of Possible Lying individually and looks for hard evidence, rather than zooming out a little bit and realizing that the evidence is in the fact that virtually everything he says is at the very least incredibly suspect and at worst a cartoonish laughable fiction. By the way, are they still eating the cats and dogs or has that stopped? Oh, and of course, when I say laughable, obviously, I mean not laughable. My point, I guess, is that there are always rules, but the Times is using the wrong ones. Old rules, rules that aren't useful today. The world, and since this is the podcast about the hard work of creativity rather than a John Oliver recap show, the world and the arts have always had rules. And the thing is that these rules have never been strict or constant or rigid. They pretend to be, and we kind of have to believe that they are, but really, they're malleable, ever-changing. Whenever an artistic movement claims to break the rules, I'm not sure that they ever are. I mean, sure, it sounds super cool to be able to say that. Makes you sound like an artistic outlaw, a wild card, and we all want to be that. And it's great to feel like you're that if that gets you to where you need to be creatively, but if you break rules successfully, by which I mean it pays off in terms of artistic success, then what you've really done is changed the rules, made new rules, amended the Constitution. You know when there's a stretch of elevator, that runs around a corner, and that corner that it runs around is grass. You know how people cut the corner and walk across the grass? You know how, when people do that regularly, their footsteps make a little path? You know what that's called? It's called a desire line. And it feels like some rules, not all, but a lot, get remade like that.
Every desire line is started by a rule breaker. But they haven't rejected the idea of paths, they've just made a new one for others to follow. One that they think is better.
So I guess what I'm saying is that in the world of creativity, you need rules, and you need rule breakers. But at the same time, neither of them are quite what they appear to be. They're not in opposition to each other. You don't have to pick a side, they're part of the same thing. Rule breakers think they're revolutionary, but they're actually evolutionary. Almost every rule, maybe I haven't looked at all of the rules, but still, almost every rule was at one point the breaking, or at least the modification, of an existing rule. I always thought of myself as a rule breaker when I was a street performer. I mean, can there be anything more rebellious than deciding that a patch of street or piazza is your theatre just because you say so? And that is true, of course, but only today. In the past, performances started on the street,
travelling players who would perform in market squares.
Then, rule breakers had the idea of putting them in taverns. Then, these taverns became music halls. Then, they became theatres with a tavern still attached but as a theatre bar. Every stage of that journey involved breaking rules and making new ones. So much so that a performer going outside back onto the streets where their art form started is a rule breaker. So, obey rules. Or break them. Or ignore them. Or make them. Do whatever you want to do within, outside, or around every system of rules that you come across. Be driven by your creativity, not by feeling cool by breaking rules or feeling pure about obeying them. Rules should be a small consideration to your art, but nothing more. In the words of the immortal Bob Dylan, wiggle, 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 like a bowl of soup. He is apparently a genius. Talk to you soon, Matt.
Imagination and Junk is written by Bill Barol in the U.S. and Matt Ricardo in the U.K., with audio production by Bill Barol. For more information, show notes, and bonus content, it's imaginationandjunk.com.